Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through Deities and Demigods, the 1980 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Cthulhu Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, a section based on the work of H.P. Lovecraft and his collaborators and successors that was removed from later editions of the book following a licensing dispute. In today's episode, we're going to take a look at the alien Great Race of Yith and Hastur the Unspeakable. So let's get started. First up, we have the Great Race of Yith. They're just called the Great Race in the book. These are a Lovecraft creation, and they first appeared in the story The Shadow Out of Time. Well, I say they first appeared. They appear in the story The Shadow Out of Time. Lovecraft wrote this story over a period from 1934 to 1935, and it was published in 1936. So this is one of Lovecraft's later works. Most of Lovecraft's fiction was published in the weird fiction, horror, or whatever you want to call it, magazine, Weird Tales. But this one was not. This one comes from science fiction pulp Astounding Stories. And I think it's telling that this is in Astounding Stories and that it was sold by Julius Schwartz, who we, of course, associate with science fiction and superheroes, right? I mean, Julius Schwartz, perhaps better known for his work at DC Comics. Because the Great Race of Yith are a very science fictional species, and their entry in Deities and Demigods, this is the first entry, I think, that really, it's not wrong, but it just misses the point of the creatures, because it doesn't tell you what they do, and what they do is the whole point of them. So the Great Race of Yith are a highly advanced civilization of super intelligent beings that take the shape of this, you know, weird cone with tentacles coming out the top. So here's the deal about the Great Race of Yith. For all the description of these tall rugose cones, those are not the actual bodies of the Great Race of Yith. The Great Race of Yith are an extraterrestrial race who are able to travel through time and space by switching their minds with the bodies of another species. So these cone-shaped beings lived in Earth's distant past, and the Great Race of Yith are from this other place, presumably Yith, and they switch their minds with those beings. And those beings probably didn't appreciate it because they wound up with their minds in the original Great Race of Yith as the Yithian civilization was being destroyed. So the Yithians live in this civilization. They build this great library city in Earth's distant past. And they fill their library by sending out their minds across time and space. So a Yithian is able to switch its mind with a human, in this instance, a guy called Nathaniel Wingate Peasley. And so Peasley seems to all the people around him to suffer like some kind of, he has a stroke or something. And then when he awakens, he's completely different. And so the Yithians can go around and study and research and learn in modern civilization. And meanwhile, back in the distant past, in their ancient city, they are getting the person whose mind they've brought back into a Yithian body to fill up their library with all of their knowledge about the time and place that they come from. And then when they're done, they switch them back. And so the narrative of the story is that Peasley discovers that, you know, other people throughout history have suffered the same thing, and he remembers dimly the city in dreams, and he goes and he finds the ancient city of the Yithians, which is in ruins and is inhabited by these monstrous species that they were fighting way back in the distant past, the flying polyps. And it turns out that the Yithians, basically to avoid the like apocalypse of their civilization, did what they did before and just transplanted their minds into some other bodies far in the future. So they just kept going, right? They're beings of pure consciousness, and they just abandon their bodies when things look like they're getting bad and switch them with some other poor sucker who winds up stuck in whatever bad position the Yithians were originally in. So, immediately, this inspires two scenarios. The first is, of course, that a Yithian switches their mind with some person in your campaign. So, like, oh, we're going to go see old so-and-so, the wizard, but man, she's acting funny, like, she doesn't seem to remember us, and she's asking all kinds of weird questions, and she's sending us off on all kind of quests to get, you know, whatever strange knowledge. A Yithian, of course, wouldn't be interested in objects, because their method of travel doesn't allow them to take anything with them. So a Yithian sent into the future would be looking for information, but not anything else, because the information is the only thing that they can take back. But so they might very well join an adventuring party in order to gain new knowledge, or they might become a patron to a group of adventurers and send them out to go and learn new information, go and, you know, explore some ruins or whatever. as an adventuring party might. The other is that the library city of the Great Race is essentially a dungeon, and in the story The Shadow Out of Time, we have this archaeological expedition which goes to excavate it and discovers that it is in fact inhabited by the monstrous creatures that destroyed the Great Race of Yith. So we have a sunken city in the sands of the Australian outback that is full of monsters and also the collected learning and technology of an ancient civilization. So that sounds like a dungeon to me. So in that sense, the Great Race of Yith adapt very smoothly into Dungeons & Dragons or another fantasy RPG. The downside is that they're very science fictional. Lovecraft has often been described as someone who melded science fiction and horror, but while a lot of the elements of fantasy fiction come from authors who were Lovecraft's contemporaries, and while Lovecraft himself is in Appendix N, you have to be a little careful when you include science fiction elements in your fantasy game. Now, obviously, Dungeons & Dragons has been doing that since forever, with greater and lesser degrees of success. I think that the Yithians, you can get away with it. Because the entry for the Yithians in the Deities and Demigods book says that they use psionics rather than magic. And that, I think, is because psionics are more science fictional. And that's fine. Because the Yithian civilization is very ancient in its feel, right? So big stone buildings, libraries, strange devices that no one can understand. But they haven't, like, come here in a spaceship. And while they probably do have items of technology, if you wanted to say that, like, for the most part, they do everything through psionics, I think that's also fine. So I think that it's not that hard to adapt the Yithians to a fantasy setting, even though all the stuff about aliens and psychic powers and time travel is very science fictional. Also, the Yithians sent their minds not into our present, but into an era far, far in our future, after mankind has been destroyed. And I think that you can sort of incorporate that into the role of Yithians in your fantasy game, right? Like, here's this Yithian, and they're mapping all these things, and you say, you know, oh, great wizard, like, not to question your wisdom, but why are you having us map out all these places? And the wizard goes, oh, well, that's going to be important because in the future, I want to know where the resources all are, after the great apocalypse has wiped out, you know, elvenkind. And you say, I'm sorry, oh great wizard, but what was that about an apocalypse? Because Yithians have access to time travel, they're a great way to put kind of portents of the future into your game. And in fact, you know, in many ways, they might be opposed to you trying to prevent the great apocalypse, because when you're completely ethereal and you can go to any part of time or space that you want, the temptation to bug out in the face of a threat is presumably great. In fact, they transfer into insect bodies, so bug out is really relevant here, but is not great for all the people who don't have that option. So the player characters, presumably representing the group of people who don't have that option, would have to try and take a different approach, which would mess up the plans of the Yithians. And you can see that the Yithians would be kind of detached about this. All these people are going to die unless we prevent the great apocalypse. Well, look, all these people are going to die anyway at some point. You know, we're talking about going 10,000 years into the future. You're all going to be dead one way or another. So I think the Great Race Yith are a fun scenario base. I think that the problem with having a race of creatures that is basically associated with a twist ending is that if your players are like mine, everybody will just say, oh yeah, that's the Shadow Out of Time by H.P. Lovecraft. I know what the Great Race of Yith are. You can get away with the wizards acting funny and the answer being the Great Race because wizards acting funny is a feature of the D&D landscape. But once you start to get more specific than that, I feel like the odds are good that you'll have at least one player at your table who's read this story and knows what's up. So you probably want to actually, rather than using the Great Race of Yith, you want to take the story, The Shadow Out of Time, but maybe translate it into a slightly different format. Because the bit about bodiless consciousnesses traveling over time, that's the bit that matters. And the bit about the 10-foot Rugos cones is just Lovecraft going, yeah, things wouldn't look like people. Next up on the list, we've got Hastur the Unspeakable. Spoken. Now, normally, I tell you at the beginning of this section whether a deity is a Lovecraft creation or a Durlith creation or what, but is actually rather more complex than that in the case of Hastur, because it all depends what you mean by creation. Hastur is a name that appears in the writings of a couple of weird fiction authors who predate Lovecraft. Ambrose Bierce, perhaps best known for his journalism, his book The Devil's Dictionary, and his mysterious disappearance during the Mexican Civil War. It ain't that mysterious. So he uses the name for a god in one of his stories. And then Robert W. Chambers takes the name Hestor, along with a couple of other things from Bierce, and again just name drops them in his collection, The King in Yellow. Now, that name sounds familiar to you, I imagine, and you probably think of it in connection with Hestor, and that is because, like, the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game and, like, later Cthulhu fiction have taken as writ the assertion that the King in Yellow is an avatar of the god Hestor. But this isn't necessarily the case. Lovecraft mentions Hestor and the King in Yellow in the same breath in his story, The Whisperer in Darkness, but it's a little bit less obvious than you think. So in The Whisperer in Darkness, these terms turn up in a letter supposedly from one character, Akeley, to another one, Wilmarth. He's talking about an alien race who we'll get to at some point, the fungi from Yuggoth. Says, actually, they have never knowingly harmed men, but have often been cruelly wronged and spied upon by our species. There is a whole secret cult of evil men. A man of your mystical erudition will understand me when I link them with Hestor and the Yellow Sign, devoted to the purpose of tracking them down and injuring them on behalf of monstrous powers from other dimensions. It is against these aggressors, not against normal humanity, that the drastic precautions of the Outer Ones are directed. Incidentally, I learned that many of our lost letters were stolen not by the Outer Ones, but by the emissaries of this malign cult. So, leaving aside the fact that it's very possible that this cult doesn't exist at all, because a lot of this letter is not true, Lovecraft is doing a thing that Lovecraft does. It's one of his most effective world-building techniques. And world-building isn't the right word for it. One of his most effective atmosphere creation techniques. Lovecraft is just dropping a veiled reference to something that there's not a good chance that his readers will have heard of. Robert W. Chambers is well-known kind of in geek culture today, or at least the King in Yellow and the Yellow Sign are, but I don't think that was the case during Lovecraft's era. I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that Lovecraft is largely responsible for the rediscovery of Robert Chambers' weird fiction, because Chambers was primarily known as a writer of sort of romance stories, and then he also wrote this kind of weird stuff in the 19th century. In one of Lovecraft's letters, he says something to the effect of, there's amazing stuff written by, of all people, Robert Chambers. You know, the romance guy. So Lovecraft is dropping this reference, kind of, it doesn't really mean anything. He's just saying like, oh yeah, you know what I'm talking about, as if to establish that this is between two people who know a lot about the occult. And he's doing it in a way that Lovecraft has a tendency to mix things that are his creations and things that exist elsewhere. So remember that we're in a world before the internet. You can't just Google Hestor Yellow Sign when you read this. So ideally you're reading this and you go, ah, sounds like some cool occult business, Hestor and the Yellow Sign. And then maybe one day you come across Bierce or Chambers' reference to Hestor and you're like, huh, maybe there is this belief that people have in it. I don't know. And Lovecraft does this a lot. So like when he talks about Abdul al-Hazred, the made-up author of the Necronomicon, he includes him in lists that include real authors. It's a very characteristically Lovecraftian technique. Or not just real authors, but people who were created by other weird fiction writers. And this all blending together things that Lovecraft created, things that other authors created, and things that are real helps give a general sense of verisimilitude to the whole thing. So there we have Hestor up to H.P. Lovecraft. Hestor is a god in the works of Bierce, but he's not some kind of sinister cosmic god. He's just like a god in a kind of fantastic setting. And in Chambers and Lovecraft, he's mentioned, but in ways that are quite ambiguous about what exactly a Hestor is. Now, August Derleth, bless him, was more someone who really loved Lovecraft's writing than someone who really got Lovecraft's writing, if that makes sense. Maybe that's the unfair judgment of history. The critical consensus has come down that Lovecraft's writing is different from what Derleth thought it was. But for a long time, I don't think that was really true, right? Derleth dominated our understanding of Lovecraft for a good while. And Derleth had a somewhat fannish attitude toward, well, an extremely fannish attitude toward Lovecraft, and what he thought would be really great was if all these little cryptical references were fully explained so that we understood what they were. So he wrote a bunch of stuff about Hestor, and in it he established the connection between Hestor and the Yellow Sign, and he said that Hestor was the child of Yog-Sothoth and Cthulhu's half-brother, and that's why they were opponents, and that while Cthulhu represented, like, water creatures, Hestor was a creature of the stars, or maybe of air, it isn't clear. This book calls him an air god, but then in the next episode we're going to have Ithaqua, who's also an air god, so I don't know about that. The problem with Derleth's Hestor, and he further went on to say that Hestor has a bunch of avatars, among whom is the King in Yellow. And what this means is that most modern interpretations of Hestor have focused on the idea that he's a god of kind of surreal madness, that he's a god of the kind of situations that you get in a Robert Chambers story where it's not really clear what's real and what's a hallucination, and There's a sort of dreamlike quality to a lot of things. And that has given Hestor a very distinct identity among the deities of the Cthulhu mythos. Whereas in Durlath's conception, he's clearly just kind of an inferior Cthulhu, right? He's like Cthulhu, but without all the things that make Cthulhu cool and atmospheric. He's just another evil god. And I think Durlath saw this undeveloped area as one where he could kind of make his mark. Indeed, he suggests that at one point, he's the one who coined the term the Cthulhu mythos, I think, but prior to that, he proposed calling it the mythology of Hastur, probably because Hastur is the thing that appears not just in Lovecraft, but also in Bierce and in Chambers. So this is another example of a case where we have Durlath to thank for a lot of stuff, but also kind of the result is that Durlath's Hastur is just like, if you went into the shop and said, cut me off one standard length of malevolent cosmic deity, that's what you'd get. There's no situation under which your game would be improved by having the antagonist of the story be Hastur as presented in the Deities and Demigods book and not Cthulhu. The only thing that really stands out is this idea that the cults of Cthulhu and Hastur are rivals. That is interesting. The explanation given that Hastur is Cthulhu's half-brother is just such a tone-deaf thing to say about the Cthulhu mythos, right? This isn't Mount Olympus. These gods don't have petty family squabbles. Even like cold strategic rivalries and battles for resources are kind of naturalizing in a way that doesn't really help. You know, we talked before about understandable motivations. If we were battling for money and power and prestige, then that's definitely an understandable motivation. So I think you could definitely have the cults of Hastur and Cthulhu be at odds in your Dungeons & Dragons game. This might actually turn the fact that Hastur is otherwise just more or less the same as Cthulhu into a virtue rather than a flaw. Like, the thing about the cult of Hastur is that they hate the cult of Cthulhu, even though they're actually pretty much the same. I think you could do something with that. Hastur is also a fine evil deity to have a bunch of cultists trying to summon when you just want to thwart a bunch of cultists trying to summon an evil deity and it doesn't really matter what. Durlath also decided that Hastur was unnameable, and I think this comes from another Lovecraft reference where Lovecraft talks about the great unnamed or the great unnameable, and Durlath goes, okay, well, I'll tie that into Hastur and say, you know, you can't speak his name. If you speak his name, there's a chance that he or his servants will appear. On the one hand, I like that. I like the idea that it's a... I think that that has some promise. I mean, first off, it's a very fairy tale-y way of thinking about something, right? Oh, if you say the name of something, it will appear. You know, a bit like the Candyman or Bloody Mary or whatever. I think that works out pretty well. Secondly, if we are going to accept the connection of Hastur to the King in Yellow, then the idea that if you say Hastur's name, it appears, or its servants appear, goes to something that has turned up in the work of later Cthulhu mythos writers, which is the idea that Hastur is essentially an informational deity, right? The King in Yellow, it's a play of the same name, and it's also a character in the play, and there's some kind of confusion between the effects of the King in Yellow in italics, the play, and the King in Yellow, the being, which is to say that Hastur might be information. You know, the Chamber stories are all about perception being messed up and information possibly being poisonous, and they're very much about what today we would call, you know, memetics, that the King in Yellow is an idea. And if you say, okay, well, you know, when you say Hastur's name, Hastur might appear, that's because Hastur's name is Hastur, right? Hastur's name is part of the god. You know, your name is you in some way. And so we could tie Hastur into the idea of poisonous information, information that you're better off not knowing, but that once you know it, you can't unknow it. And that is a recurring theme in the Cthulhu mythos, and it's a place that later writers have sort of put Hastur, and I think it works. The only problem with it is that later on we're going to get to Nyarlathotep, and that's already kind of his gimmick, sort of. But still, it gives us something to do with Hastur. He can either be kind of generic heavy, or he can be mimetic warfare deity, and I think either of them is fine. But I think also in both cases, they owe very little to what Bierce, Chambers, or Lovecraft meant when they wrote that name. Anyway, that's the Great Race and Hastur. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at Ithaqua the Windwalker, and the Migo, the fungi from Yuggoth, on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.